Rabbits. So actually, I think it is pretty close to time, and since we have lots of stuff we want to try and cover, we'll go ahead and get started. Anybody that you know is late walking in is just going to have to miss a little bit. Thanks to all of you for coming by to hear our presentation today. Out of curiosity, how many of you have heard me present one or more of the previous talks in this sort of series? And how many of you have never heard Keith or me give a talk anywhere before? Wow, that's so cool. Fresh meat. Okay, so what we want to talk to you about today is this shared passion that Keith and I have about playing around with high-powered model rockets. Just to give you a sense of scale, that one is a 98-millimeter diameter airframe that's about 3 meters long. And
so bigger than B-Dale.
Yeah, taller than me. And I really wish I'd gotten it back. if you've heard me talk before, that's Yik-Stick. That was my first Level 3 certification attempt rocket. We'll talk more about that later. But first off, just who are we? I don't know. we're two grown men with a shared chemical dependency. or after. It's an ammonium perchlorate composite propellant, by the way.
We have dealers. They give away free samples.
Yeah, they call themselves dealers, and they give away free samples. So, and after hearing Mako's talk this morning, I should make it clear that, as you can see from you know the things we do in our day jobs, we are indeed strategic business partners. but I think the real message here is that we're two guys who have been doing free software stuff for a very long time and have, you know, through the luck of the draw and hard work and perseverance and, you know, pulling hair out and
putting hair back in.
Yeah, growing it back. we've ended up, you know, we're good friends and we like to play with things, but we've now both sort of ended up in the situation through this project of having a reputation for trying to turn our other hobbies into free software projects, which I don't think is a bad thing at all. So the basic idea of what I want to talk to you about today is this shared love that we have for building, launching, and successfully recovering hobby-sized models of various rockets. And part of what makes this so exciting is that it's one of those hobbies that allows you to bring all sorts of interests together in one place. There's the whole sort of engineering aspect, designing, sort of coming up with objectives of things you'd like to do, figuring out what sort of airframes and payloads and things you need to do that. My son, who just turned 11 last week, who's sort of our number one rocket buddy and primary test pilot for our avionics, is really enjoying the physical craftsmanship aspect right now. He also really likes the fact that this is a wonderful excuse to go camping in the middle of nowhere. And that, of course, is because when you start building really big rockets, when things don't go well, it's good to not be anywhere near where people live and things like that. So one of the common themes that you'll notice in the photos and video and things we're going to show you is that there aren't a whole lot of signs of life in the background in the photos. We tend to fly these things in deserts.
I prefer your grassland to my desert.
Yes, this is true. The high plains of Colorado in an area called the Pawnee National Grasslands is actually one of our favorite launch sites right now. It's many tens of thousands of acres of sort of rolling, relatively flat grass.
Very short grass.
You know, a few rattlesnakes. You have to watch out for the antelope in October because it's the opening weekend of antelope season. You don't want to be too close to the antelope, and particularly you want to leave your antler hats at home. But yeah, and one of the things I like to point out is this hobby is a wonderful intersection of geek and redneck culture. And what I mean by that... and I mean it in the nicest sort of way, and I sort of can claim to have one foot firmly in both of those camps. There really is a visceral thrill associated with every launch. You know, Yeah, right. I am a federally licensed user of low explosives in the U.S., though as of this spring, it's no longer a necessity to have that particular license because we won a federal court case, which you may have read about on Slashdot and other places, and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives was forced by federal court to vacate their decision that ammonium perchlorate composite propellant should be classed as an explosive. It is no longer. In fact, in the new version of their rules that were published, it's the one explicitly exempted chemical where it flat out says, this is not an explosive. And so that's very cool. It makes it much easier now to buy and fly big motors, at least in the U.S.
Our chemical dependency is no longer illegal.
it no longer requires expensive licensing and giving, you know, fingerprints and retinal scans and so forth to your government. And, you know, obviously we wouldn't be here talking about this if this didn't somehow end up leading to, you know, electronics and software. And so the role of avionics in all of this, I think, is fundamentally, you know, the first big deal is we do like to recover these things. We like to get them back. And getting them back means being able to control the deployment of things like parachutes so that we can safely recover rockets that sometimes end up being
thousands of dollars
and hundreds of kilos at launch. So these are big honking toys, big boy toys, as my wife likes to say. And then sort of, you know, the second big thing that matters a lot to us, because we're both sort of science and engineering types, is the collection of flight data.
Actually, that's a key distinction between the redneck and geek faction.
Right.
The rednecks want to get the parts back, and the geeks want to get
the data
back.
Yes. When rockets get lost, you can tell who somebody is by whether they're lamenting the fact that they're going to have to build another airframe before they can fly again, or whether they're grousing over the fact that they didn't get the data, so they don't know what went wrong. And you know, as you go along, I sort of joked about losing part of the rocket that was on the title slide, and I'll reprise that photo at various points during the talk because, you know, I missed that rocket. But this sort of led to an intense interest on our part in the radio telemetry and, you know, location.
Oh, and we're also both amateur radio operators, so
yes,
radios are cool.
Playing with radios is a good thing, right? Out of curiosity, how many of you have amateur radio licenses? And why don't the rest of you? It's like free bandwidth to go play with. And you know, well, anyway,
yeah,
that's another talk for another day. In fact, that was a talk we gave, and Hugh and I gave in Adelaide? I don't remember. It doesn't matter. Okay, so how did we end up working on this particular project? Well, it's the classic story of BDL found another excuse to turn a hobby into a
free software project.
There are a lot of people making and selling commercial off-the-shelf bits of avionics for use in the high-power rocketry community. And some of them are really quite good. And we know some of these people personally, and they're really nice people. But it's the usual set of problems. You know, the documentation sort of application-oriented. You don't get schematics. You usually don't get source code. And when you do get source code, it's for the first version of the firmware, and they haven't ever bothered to put out the updated version because they don't think anybody cares. And so at the end of the day, there's really no ability to modify the behavior, no ability to fix things. The reason I'm missing part of that first rocket is a firmware bug in a commercial altimeter that caused the main parachute to go out at apogee instead of at low altitude on a rocket that, you know, should have hit Mach 1.68 on the way to 17,000 feet above ground, and, you know, disappeared into a cloud bank and was never seen from again. So all of these things sort of got my juices flowing to do something about this, and as someone who has a background in the right kind of electronics, it just seemed like a fun project to tackle. And then at a conference that we were attending together in California on the 7th of November of 2008, Keith and I had one of those interesting moments where I was sort of on the cusp of whether to make a fundamental design change in the hardware, which would require throwing out all the software and starting over. And it just seemed like sort of a big hassle. And Keith was sitting next to me and says, oh, that'd be fun to work on. If you want, I'll help you with that. And having someone of Keith's caliber as a programmer as your personal code monkey is just, you know.
When Intel doesn't let me write code anymore anyhow, so this was an opportunity for me to actually get back into software.
As I think John Oxer and others have pointed out, one of the cool things about playing with microcontrollers is that it is really possible for one person to wrap their brain around all the details of the system and to completely understand what's going on. This is not true of chasing down, you know, race conditions in DMA on PCI buses or... never mind, sorry.
Interrupt races, BDL. Yeah. It's all about the interrupt
yeah,
races.
Yeah, well, okay. All right, so let me talk a little bit about the hardware that we designed. As of LCA last year, we were to the stage where we had some bare circuit boards, if I recall correctly, and I was really looking forward to getting home and soldering some together, and that happened. Let me reprise just a little bit what's on these boards. The magic part, if you will, is a TI ChipCon part, the CC1111. This is a 36-pin QFN, itsy-bitsy little thing, that has an 8051 microcontroller, gross architecture, I know the guy that designed the architecture, and he's a nice guy, but this processor should have died decades ago.
He should have drunk more that night at the bar. He would have forgotten.
32K of flash, 4K of RAM. It has full USB target interface, you know, A to D, blah, blah, blah. But the really important part is that it has this full sub-1 gigahertz radio transceiver, digital radio transceiver on the part. That's the ChipCon magic. And that's what makes this whole thing so much fun and so cool. And I can buy those from DigiKey for about $7 quantity one in the U.S. The only problem, of course, is it's a 36-lead QFN, and how the heck do you solder those? We'll get to that in a minute. We put an external non-volatile memory part on for gathering data, set of, you know, relatively interesting sensors. Something that at the time was completely unique within the hobby rocketry community was the idea of integrated support for rechargeable batteries. I don't know what it is about these guys. They build $1,000 rockets, and then they trust them to a 9-volt alkaline cell. And in fact, they trust them to fresh 9-volt alkaline cells per flight, because I guess it makes economic sense. If you spend $1,000 on an airframe and you're putting a few $100 in propellant, what's a few dollars for fresh batteries among friends? But just seem wrong, and they're very heavy.
And the connectors suck.
And one of the commitments I made to myself early on is 100% open source, not only for the design, but for all of the tools used to create the design. I have not used one piece of non-open source software in the whole process. Keith briefly was stuck using a non-open source 8051 assembler at the bottom of the SDCC stack.
It was open source. I had the source available, but it wasn't free software.
It had one of those non-commercial use license clause things. But thanks to some help from our SDCC maintaining friends, of which I sadly ended up being one, in the Debian project, that got fixed, and that assembler system got relicensed GPL v3, so we are now literally absolutely using nothing that isn't free software in the creation of this. I like the GEDA toolset, the GPL EDA toolset.
I think BDL stands alone in that. Every other person I know designing electronic circuits.
Actually, that's not true. John told me that, and Hugh told me that all the schematics in their new Arduino book
really?
Are done in that
Good
toolset.
Job.
Matt Edis used it for the USRP boards. A lot of people are using it now. It doesn't suck nearly as much as it used to.
Yeah.
And I have to tell you that, in particular, the design rule checking stuff in that tool suite is really, really good. It does all the correct algebraic things to figure out whether the spacings that you've told it are being violated. It doesn't do the stupid thing that a lot of, you know, hobbyist tools do of, you know, trying to do everything on a grid and getting it wrong. There are a bunch of other things I've talked about before, some online sites like freedfm.com, where you can go and get design for manufacturability checking on any set of Gerber and Exelon files you want to upload. I actually purchase raw circuit boards through a cheap four-layer board service that's available from an outfit in the outskirts of Denver. Stencils Unlimited up in Oregon cuts beautiful.
Oh, we didn't bring
beautiful.
A stencil. Hmm? We didn't bring one of the stencils.
Yeah, the stencils, those are really beautiful stainless steel laser-cut stencils that make it possible to screen the boards with solder paste. And then I'm hand-placing 0402 scale surface mount and all the other parts. I'm using tweezers and an inspection microscope that my wife and kids very much appreciate. It gave me for Christmas 2-3 years back. And then the killer tool in all this is the $20 electric skillet and the infrared thermometer. I'll show you that in just a sec. So, you know, I also like to do home shop machining stuff. This is my little milling machine being used to rip raw circuit boards out of the panels that we get back from the PC board fab. I'll pass one of the panels of the new boards around. Please leave it in the bag, because that one's actually going to get loaded and flown, and I just soon keep your finger grease off the... Anyway, when we get the panels like that, you know, I have to cut the boards apart so that I can actually assemble them and put them together. This is a photo of the assembly area. My neat hack is I use these little mini muffin tins.
Hey, that was my hack.
Your hack? Well, I don't know.
I told you
we were, trying to figure out what to use for staging parts. And the mini muffin tins are cool because they're stamped out of aluminum, so you can ground it and, you know, keep static-sensitive parts safe. I don't know if you can actually see, but I use G-labels to print little labels with all the information from my bill of materials and stick them in the individual cups. And then I spend an hour and a half going through and counting out the precise right number of all these itty-bitty little parts using the magnifying light to be able to see them, folded piece of laser printer paper as a staging area to get the right amount counted out, drop them all in. so that then once I've screened solder paste onto the boards and I'm, you know, working through the microscope to place them, I can just, you know, rush through. There's no fumbling around with parts, bins, and all that sort of stuff. And so in terms of the amount of time it takes about somewhere between an hour and a half to stage parts for as many boards as I can stand to load at once, because the hard part is handling all the individual containers of parts and getting them staged right. To load three boards, which is what I have down there, is about the most I can do before my back is ready to kill me from being hunched over the microscope. I can do those three boards in about an hour and 15 minutes of load time to place all of the teeny tiny little parts on there. And it takes about 5 minutes to reflow solder them and fix any soldering issues that show up. So elapsed time ends up being something like an hour of my time per board that we load. But I'm dead serious about the frying pan. That's $20 from Walmart. And it's one of the interesting hacks is that these, you know, electric frying pan things have a heating element that's in a big loop. And I'm putting the board sort of in the center of the pan quite intentionally. I'm taking advantage of the thermal inertia in the cast pan to make it possible to sort of hit the right thermal profile. If you turn the heating element on all the way up, I mean, it doesn't matter because it's binary. It's either putting electricity in the heating element or it's not. But you turn it on, you start shooting the surface of the circuit boards with an infrared non-contact thermometer and watching the temperature. And you watch it come up, and as soon as the surface of the board just barely comes into the bottom of the preheat temperature range, which for the solder paste I'm using is 110 degrees C, you're supposed to hold it there for a minute between 110 and 150 C. Well, if you turn the heating element off, there's enough heat that's been put into the rest of the pan that the boards sort of float up towards 150. Just before they get there, the pan starts to cool back down, and before it drops below 110 again, it's been long enough, you've, you know, achieved the preheat interval, you turn the heat on again all the way up, and just start watching until everything reflows. And that starts to happen at about 190 degrees C, at which point I pull my magnifying lamp over and quit worrying about the board temperature and just watch. Because the solder paste is sort of a dull gray until it reflows, and then it gets really shiny, and there's a little bit of yellowy flux stuff in there, and you can see when that's sort of burned off and everything gets really shiny, and then you're done. You turn the heat off, you start gently blowing underneath the bottom of the pan to cool the pan down more quickly. Within about 2 minutes, it's dropped down below 150 C. You use tweezers to lift the boards out, set them down on the paper, and about a minute later, they're cool enough to handle, and you put them under the microscope and, you know, pray that you don't have too many things to fix. The last set of three boards that I loaded, one was perfect, and the other two each had one solder bridge between adjacent pins on the 36-lead QFN. That actually kind of makes me happy when I see one of those bridges, because it means the QFN has actually slurped itself down tight enough to the board to squeeze out the extra little bit of solder from the one opening on the laser cut stencil that seems to be a little bit too big. We have fun with these. This is what a version 0.1 board looked like. And to let you know, that's 1 by 2.5 inches, so that's what, 25.4 millimeters by whatever, what's two? Yeah, Keith's holding one. Vanuul model, yes. And that's pretty much.
Should I pass one of these around?
Yeah, pass at least one of those around.
Okay.
We will happily pass these around. Feel free to handle them, look at them, stare at them. Try not to drool on them, particularly not on the barometric sensor. It doesn't like moisture. And I do expect to get them all back, or I will hunt you down and kill you, okay?
Remember, each one took an hour of his time.
At least. To put together. And in fact, these take longer than that because there were some mistakes in the copper. We'll come back to that, though. Keith, software.
Absolutely. Well, as we said, BDL and I met in November of last year. No, 2 years ago.
A year and change.
And BDL said, you know, I'm really tired of writing software for these things, and I need some help and some, you know, some collaboration. So I said, that sounds like a great fun project. I've been working in rocket control software for a couple years prior with a university group in the Portland, the PSAS group. And so I had some experience in writing flight control software. I had an idea of what I was going to be up to. So the first question was, we're going to use this crazy TI part, the CC1111. How do we debug this? Right? It's an embedded controller. Usually what do you need for an embedded controller to debug it? You need some proprietary embedded debugger puck, or, you know.
TI sells it for $5,000.
$500.
Yeah,
is it really?
The full developer kit's $5,000.
$5,000. Yeah, and I said, I don't want to pay that, and I don't think anybody else want to pay that either. So I got the documentation for the chip. TI offers, actually, of the TI parts, this is an extremely well-documented part, and it said there was a little three-wire bit-banging debug interface that was, you know, totally documented and easy to do. So what I did is I got this CP2103 serial USB chip that also happens to have four GPIO pins that can be controlled with the Linux driver. And so I wrote user mode using libusb. I wrote a little libusb application to waggle these GPIOs to talk to the debug interface on the CC1111. And at the astounding rate of 0.5 clock per USB packet, I can send packet. I can, you know, twaddle the bits on this device and read and write to it. And we actually managed to get to the point where I could load code and execute code on the CC1111 using nothing but this existing free software driver and some user mode code that I wrote on Linux. So there was no additional hardware at all. I spent, you know, this TI made this little dev board for $50. And that's all I had to buy.
Right.
But that was a little slow. It was literally one USB packet, you know, a high speed.
He says a little slow.
Okay, and the debug interface, actually what you do to debug the device is you send instructions down in binary. You know, you send the binary instruction down and then ask the CPU to execute it. And then it returns the result to you in the accumulator. So you send an instruction down, the accumulator comes back. So to load code on it, you actually say, put this byte in, you know, you send instructions to put this byte in this location of memory. That's literally how you load stuff on it. So you send three or four instructions per byte that you're loading into memory. And every instruction takes a bunch of additional debug stuff. It's like the debug command is to run this instruction. The instruction is 4 bytes long. Here are the 4 bytes of the instruction. Oh, and tell me what the result is. So, and the result is for every byte, you're sending down probably 10 bytes of data. And for every byte of data you have to send down, you have to twaddle the bits 20 times. So 20 USB packets per byte and 20 USB packets per...
You get the impression this takes forever.
Yeah.
But it worked.
So,
it worked.
Yeah. So the first thing I had to debug was the USB stuff so I could actually run USB on the CC1111. So I could actually write my own USB driver and talk to it in a more efficient fashion. So it took about, way too long to get a USB driver working because I had to learn how USB worked. If anybody wants to know, USB is awful. And I think Sarah's giving a talk on USB later in the week. Her opinion of USB is way higher than mine. And she doesn't think much of it either. But so I wrote a USB driver, and then we actually got to get, you know, a higher level. And I also stole Greg KH's Beagle USB hardware monitor, which is not free software. So one piece of
that's your problem, not mine.
Actually, yeah. I don't know that I would have gotten USB working without this device, but at least it does run on Linux. And then I finally managed to get to the CC1111-based debugging. You know, if I'd known how USB worked, I probably wouldn't have needed it. Did you know that USB is a poll protocol to get data back from the device? You have to ask it? I had no idea.
I think if Keith had any idea what he was getting into, he might never have volunteered.
Oh, no, I had great fun. This was way better than dealing with lawyers at Intel. Okay, so for the software development, so I had a basic, you know, access to the device. I had my debug link. So what did I need for software? I needed a compiler. And fortunately, the SDCC is a great little compiler for 8-bit microcontrollers. I love it. It has an 8051 target. The 8051 target does amazing magic with 8051 assembly that I just don't understand. Well, you know, at a low level, you can figure it out. It's like, it has no...
How did they get from point A to point
B? It's just amazing, yeah. So the code bloat is phenomenal because the 8051, like, it doesn't have stack pointer relative addressing. So to get arguments off the stack, you have to move the stack pointer around. Oh, my God. And it only has one stack. I have no idea. So the first thing I did was I started looking at the SDCC output and the SDCC suite. And one of the things that the SDCC comes with is a source-level debugger, SDCDB. And the only thing the SDCDB talks to is an 8051 emulator called the MCS51 emulator.
Something like that.
Something, whatever it's called. I don't even remember. And I said, wait a minute. It's talking to the emulator over a pipe. It's connecting the emulator over a pipe. It sends commands to the emulator, gets responses back. What if I emulate the emulator with something it talks to a real CPU? So I have an emulator that uses real hardware to emulate the emulator.
Which caused him to stumble over things they'd done in the emulator that you can't actually do in real hardware, and
that's another
story. But
Yeah. Well, of course, so I had to fix stuff. So what's the result? I have a source-level debugger that runs, you know, that actually executes the software on my real target. I mean, all from basically, you know, this
sand.
Wires coming out of it. Yeah, from nothing.
Two wires and sand, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Which is pretty cool. And for no money. I mean, this was done with no additional expensive hardware.
Right.
Okay. Then I had to write an operating system. I actually started out with FreeRTOS, and FreeRTOS actually has an 8051 port. Oh, my God, don't use it.
It kind of sort of worked a little bit.
Yeah, I got it to run. FreeRTOS itself took up almost all of my memory, so I had no room for my application left. I'm sure somebody finds FreeRTOS useful. In my target application, it was just not suitable.
It had way too much flexibility in things we didn't care about,
yep.
And all of those consumed resources. And about the third or fourth night, Keith reported that he just spent the last however long figuring out how to cut something out. We had this little conversation on IRC, and I said, are you to the point where it would really just be easier to start over? And
pause,
it was one of those
really
long pauses.
Pause.
And I think by about noon the next day, he had Altos kind of running.
Yeah, kind of running. Well, I mean, I've been taught for, what, 30 years of writing free software, you never rewrite. You always fix what you have because it's always easier. You're never going to be able to get to the bug level you're currently at by rewriting it, so you don't want to ever do that. But in this case, you know, it really was literally just a couple hundred lines of code to come up with a little operating system. The key thing, of course, is what you want from an operating system is to support multiple threads. It's so much easier to build almost any kind of application with threading that the primary thing that you want from your operating system is to be able to do threading and scheduling and that kind of stuff. It's just easier to think about problems in small packages. 8051 doesn't have multiple stacks. And so the way that you actually support multiple threading in the 8051 is you copy your other threads stack into the stack, and then you copy it back out. So it's kind of gross. But it does work. I decided not to build a preemptive system. I knew that I could test it adequately at real speed in order to determine if it was working correctly. So I knew that I wasn't going to have any latency issues on using a non-preemptive system because I was controlling the whole system. So the lack of determinism in a non-preemptive system wasn't a problem. I decided to just use the old classic Unix sleep and wake up for rendezvous. Very simple, very robust, easy to debug. You don't end up with weight locking. I mean, everybody wakes up when something happens. And then I added your basic OS services, you know, mutexes and timers and that kind of stuff. So I have a very primitive 8051 or other. I'm actually going to port it to a couple other microcontrollers as we go forward. But it's a really nice, simple system for building real-time or control applications. Altos is a software we built on top of that actually our flight control software. The flight control, the progress of the flight is tracked through discrete states, and we transition through states. So it's like a giant state machine. It's really easy to tell what's going on that way because the rocket knows what state it's in. It knows what it needs to do next. You do have some limitations in terms of, you know, flexibility. It's like, oh, what if this unusual thing happens? Well, you know,
it blows up.
Yeah. The rocket has a nice linear set of sequences. It's on the ground, then the motor's burning, then it gets to the top of its flight, and then it lands on the ground again. So it's a relatively easy state transition to use.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
Most of the time. Details. The rocket can tell when that doesn't happen.
we'll actually talk about that. We probably ought to keep it up because the fun part is yet to come.
Yeah, right. And we had that the flash data for storing logging data, and I said, well, why don't we just use a little bit of that to store some configuration parameters? That way you can have some persistent configuration like where to eject the main parachute and that kind of stuff. So here are the states that it has. Either it's sitting on the pad, either it's boosting and the motor is burning. The next state of the flight is when it's flying very fast. And this is an important state to be distinct from checking for when you reach the top of the flight. Because when it's traveling very fast, there's a lot of turbulence, and the pressure sensor, our barometric altimeter, gets a lot of turbulent flow as you transition through Mach. You get big pressure gradients going down your rocket. So
and this is one of the things the commercial altimeter guys cheat all the time. They have these weird things like switches where you set how many seconds after launch you want to lock out the altitude, the apogee detection, so that you have time to go through the Mach transitions and come back down. Well, if the motor burn isn't nominal and you hit apogee before the timer expires, then the rocket crashes. Not such a great plan.
Right.
So there are all sorts of different hacks people have come up with to try and work around that. It turns out if you have an accelerometer and a barosensor on the board, accelerometer only costs another $4.86 quantity 10.
Plus the
voltage regulator. Never mind. Anyway, it's not that hard to have both sensors on board. Then you can actually just know how fast you're going.
Right, you tell how fast you're going by integrating the accelerometer. Right, the accelerometer tells how much you've accelerated. You integrate it once, and you know how fast you're going. You don't have to know this very accurately. So the fact that you're integrating in constant error is not really a big deal. So what I do is I wait until I know that I think that I'm going less than 200 meters a second, well below Mach, and then I say, oh, maybe I'm getting close to the top of the flight. And that's going to be another 20 seconds before I get to the top of the flight at 10 meters a second of deceleration. Then you get to the apogee, put out the little drogue parachute, and then you float down as fast as you can to get out of the high-speed air up high in the atmosphere. And then when you get closer to the ground, you put out the main parachute, then you land.
And there are really only sort of two things on the board that have to be calibrated. One is that the radio frequency we're operating on is something you'd like to get right, both because on the ground you'd like to know where to tune your receivers to be able to find the rocket signal, but there's also regulatory issues. We're currently operating in the amateur radio frequency bands under the U.S. Part 97 rules, which gives us a lot of flexibility we wouldn't have operating in some of the commercial bands, but at the same time, you kind of would like to know where it is. And it turns out that the crystals we're using, even though for cheap crystals, they're really quite good. When you talk about 20 parts per million, by the time you get to 434 megahertz, that's on the order of like 9 kilohertz, and that's not accurate enough. So we do a simple one-shot calibration where Keith wrote some code to generate a steady carrier from the digital radio part, and we just measure that with a frequency counter, which in my case is hooked to a cesium kind of grade GPS locked reference oscillator, and we don't have any trouble telling whether the frequency is where we expect it or not. And a simple little formula allows us to figure out what the PLL sort of calibration value should be for.
And because these radios actually just use a PLL off of one crystal to generate any frequency you want. All we have to do is change the PLL parameters, and bang, you're right on the right frequency.
Yeah, there's one constant that we have to sort of determine for each board, and it's pretty easy to do. And the other calibration is for the accelerometer. There's really three things we have to cal out there. One is that the accelerometer is the only part on the board that needs 5 volts. Everything else is 3.3, but nobody makes high G accelerometers that fit our physical form factor needs that run at 3.3 volts. So we have a little 5-volt boost regulator. It's very, very stable. It was made for use in the cell phone industry. It's very quiet. We don't have any RF issues with this little switch capacitor boost regulator. But the exact output voltage of them is a little bit different between units. And because that, the output of the accelerometer is ratioed to its power supply voltage, it's therefore important to cal that out. Also, to read a 5-volt swing output with a 3.3-volt A to D, we go through a resistive divider. Even using decent quality precision resistors, there's enough variation there that we want to cal out what the actual division ratio is on a given board. And then the other cool thing that sort of came as a consequence of figuring out we had to cal those things out is the same physical footprint. I can get Freescale parts that do 40, 50, 100, or even 200 Gs plus and minus of acceleration range. And in fact, on the three boards we've built so far of the latest version of the circuit board, I loaded one each with 40, 50, and 100 G parts. And it just works beautifully, because once we realized that we could do a 2-point cal trivially, since we're in a 1G field, by pointing the board up and measuring that and pointing it down and measuring that, we can get sort of, the acceleration per A to D Q level calculated, store that away as a constant, and, we're sort of immune to all of these changes. It's surprisingly simple once you've spent enough hours arguing about it on IRC.
I don't want to do that. It's too hard.
This is my son, Robert, who some of you have met at previous LCAs. He just turned 11 last week. He's our chief test pilot and was in the process of calibrating that unit. He's staring at the frequency counter, which is up on top of the rack, writing down what the actual frequency on that board is so that he can do the algebra and figure out what to program into it. No. I've been dropped on my head on IEEE 488 enough times.
Then I wrote a UI so we could actually watch the rocket in flight. We still don't know what we want for a UI, so I put everything in the UI. I display every single statistic I could possibly think of. What state we're in, whether the parachutes have been deployed, or what speed we're going, the battery voltage, what temperature it is, all everything. And eventually I came up with four things that seemed kind of relevant that I kind of wanted to know, and I put those at the top. So we have, satellite signal strength information and GPS data. And this is a GTK application, which...
And by the way, another good way to tell whether you're dealing with geeks or rednecks at the flight line is when you bring the rocket back in and they ask you how high it went, you say 3369 meters, and they go, yeah, but how high is that? Okay, so maybe that's a U.S.-centric view of the world, but our post-processing tools as a consequence. I talked Keith into including
both
sets of numbers.
He tried to get me to put only U.S. units in.
I don't think I...
You encouraged that pretty strongly.
I don't think I ever... Well, I suggested that the values at the top of the screen here we maybe ought to do that way. So part of what this program does, it's kind of cool, is he hooked in the Festlex stuff, so it voice synthesizes and talks to you during the flight. So you can be sitting there watching the rocket, and it's telling you it just went through Apogee and deployed the drogue, and it's coming down, and, now it's on main. It's really cool.
Oh, yeah. The power of free software. We can integrate random packages from anywhere.
But on the flight line in Southern Colorado, having it announce the Apogee in meters.
How high was that?
I love those guys. You're like, how high is that? Okay, so.
And the other thing we want to know is after we get all the flight data back, or even actually from the telemetry information itself, we want to get a bunch of graphs so we can compare the performance of the motors, we can compare the recovery system, we can make sure the flight did what we wanted. So I wrote a little tool that generates SVG plots of the rocket's performance. So we have things like the altitude over time, its speed over time, and acceleration over time.
And a small footnote, if there's anybody from the OpenOffice.org world in the room, Keith would have had more sleep last night if OpenOffice dealt with SVG import correctly.
Yeah. Yeah, that got a maroon background with SVG, with OpenOffice. We're very excitable.
Okay, so now... We actually got to fly this a bunch of times this year. And so what we like to do now is sort of step through fairly quickly some of the notable flights and the interesting things that came out of that. And then we'll try to wrap up with sort of where we are, what we're planning to do next. And then we have a highly amusing little video we'll try and stick in before we get kicked out of the room. Okay, so 19th of April last year was the first time one of these boards ever flew in a rocket. In fact, my original Altus Metrum, the OpenAlt board, never did actually fly. So this is literally the first time one of my altimeter boards flew. In this case, it did not have control of the rocket. It was just along for the ride collecting data. And it turns out that we had great data collection, as you'll see, up until Apogee, and then it stopped recording. And after the flight, there's several things that I observed about the airframe. One was that there was a mounting screw in the electronics bay that had gone missing. And my theory is that when the rather stronger than it should have been ejection charge kick happened at Apogee, that screw, which must have been loose, got kicked free and probably bounced against something and shorted a power supply rail or something on the board in its departure process. And the consequence is that while this was hugely exciting, and we got an acceleration plot that we looked at, and Keith's first comment was, wow, that looks just like the manufacturer's motor curve. It was really exciting. It wasn't sort of exactly what was supposed to happen. And so the plots here, which often sort of show the action to Apogee on the left and the complete flight on the other side or vice versa, look surprisingly uniform between the two sides here. But this bottom right one, which is the acceleration during boost, that's the one that Keith looked at and said, wow, it looks exactly like
a Cicerone. The manufacturers test their motors.
Right.
So if you're buying a commercial motor, you can actually get this
picture
it looks like.
Yeah, they give you a data file so you can feed that into simulators and all that sort of stuff. That was all very exciting. Good first start.
So I decided to fly a rocket and use Telemetrum to do the deployment, and I failed to use enough black powder. Actually, the Telemetrum said that it had deployed all of its charges. When I got the rocket back, all the charges had been deployed, and the rocket was still in a hole in the ground.
Not enough black powder, so the pieces didn't separate at apogee, and so it didn't go non-aerodynamic, and it came right back in ballistically.
Yep.
The amazing thing is this rocket, which was what, Keith, about yay long?
No, it's this tall.
About that tall. Yep. There was about this much of it sticking out of the grass. In the hobby, we call this a bucket recovery.
And you don't have to picture the bucket.
It involves use of a shovel and a bucket. Some folks were amused that I commented that after we dug it out, you could see the blue streak down the dirt where it had sanded all of the paint off going in. But the really cool thing is we've been giving Keith grief all weekend at this launch about over-engineering his electronics bay and having like multiple pieces of epoxy fiberglass substrate and a gazillion screws and these big, huge, like 6-millimeter diameter, you know, U-bolts and all this incredibly heavy, beefy stuff. Well, after he did that, the board was intact enough that I plugged the USB cable in and got the data out of it. So,
yes! In June of last year, I took my rocket out to the desert in eastern Oregon.
Different rocket.
This is actually a single deployment rocket. It doesn't have two parachutes. And I actually decided to try to fly it with Telemetrum as the primary recovery system and with motor-based ejection as the backup. So I put a long delay grain in the motor so that the motor ejection would happen long after apogee and flew it. Very successful flight. Unfortunately, it also went up through the clouds and disappeared. I thought I would never see it again. But fortunately, in October, somebody was wandering around the desert and tripped over it. And so I actually got this one back. The nice thing is because we have telemetry, I had known how high it went. The sad thing was we didn't have GPS on the board yet, so I didn't know where it went.
He looked for it really hard. He just wasn't looking in the right direction.
Of course.
You know, it happens.
Yeah.
So anyway, it was cool to get data back from that flight.
Yep.
So then in September, in August.
August.
August in Colorado at the Chili Blaster event. I flew this rebuilt, those of you seen some of my photos in the past, this looks like a lot like the rocket I flew my level 1 and level 2 certifications on. Unfortunately, that one had a little mishap at apogee a while back. The recovery harness separated, it came down and ended up in pieces. This rocket, I had this notion I would just rebuild it and fly it again, but it turns out the only parts that were recoverable were the three epoxy fiberglass fins and the little rail buttons for... So as long as I was doing it, I actually completely redesigned this. It's a dual deploy, you know, sort of high-tech rocket at this point. And we flew it, and it's probably the greenest flame tail I've ever seen on a rocket I flew. That was an Aerotech Mojave Green reload. My son says don't bother with them smaller than about a K because the green's too washed out and too hard to see. But when you fly it on a K, wow, that's laser bright green. We flew this one with Telemetrum controlling the flight and a commercial altimeter as the backup. And in this case, it was a good thing we had the backup. But on the other hand, it's one of those examples of redundancy breeds complexity that makes it hard to know. You sort of have more potential points of failure. Because I had two altimeters beeping at me at launch time, I didn't realize that the Telemetrum was telling me that one of the wires was broken. And so, in fact, I think if I hadn't been flying the commercial altimeter as a backup, I might have noticed the busted wire and we might have had a happier flight. But in this case, it's okay. The backup altimeter fired the drogue, and it was very clear to us from watching video of the flight that the Telemetrum successfully deployed the main. So this was the first time that we had a rocket that we recovered the same day that had been, you know, had charges.
The first recovery that we made.
It was the first recovery we made, and it was very, very exciting. But, you know, we like even more excitement. I wanted to build sort of a brute force, you know, 98-millimeter diameter airframe to use for testing stuff. And I talked Keith into building an identical rocket. So we cut two sets of parts on the mill. And at LinuxCon in Portland in September, I delivered a handful of parts to Keith. And he had to order a couple things in a rush. And As a consequence, I got paint on mine thanks to my wife's new airbrush and Keith
didn't.
You had
an extra day because you weren't in transit.
Yeah, I did have a little more time to play. This was in the Colorado Pawnee National Grasslands. And as you can see, I beat him off the rail by about 200 milliseconds. But the Kevlar that I used for my recovery harness was slightly heftier than Keith's, to the tune of about 125 grams or so.
Something like that, yeah.
So he ended up with about 200 feet more altitude at Apogee. And the interesting thing is that with the kind of boards we have, and this was the first time that Keith and I each had a rocket that was flying only with a telemetrium with no other backup, no motor initiated ejection charges, no backup
extra,
electronics.
Yep.
These two rockets were flying completely on our avionics and firmware and so forth. And it was also the first time that we were both flying on the same weekend with GPS-enabled rockets, which means you get GPS-quality timestamps, and you can actually overlay the data and compare. And that's the two rockets flying in the drag race. You can see mine left the ground 200 milliseconds earlier.
Well, your motor lit 200 milliseconds.
Motor lit 200 milliseconds earlier.
Yeah.
You notice that they were identical motors. They're both Cesarone Pro 38 six-grain red flame motors. And you notice that because Keith's rocket was just a little bit lighter, the profiles have the same shape, but his is just slightly higher because the acceleration he got for a given amount of thrust with a slightly lighter rocket was a little higher. And then the other thing Keith pointed out is that the steepness of the barometric elevation curve...
And this lag in the barometric curve at the bottom.
You know, the lag in its starting suggests that maybe he had a little flash around the hole he drilled for the static port to let the outside air pressure get into the electronics bay or something.
Something.
So that his sensor was actually laggy in detecting the barometric pressure changes. And so there's an amazing amount of stuff that we've learned by staring at these plots. And then, of course, there's the embarrassment of this one. The nice, thick, bright line is my rocket, and if you stare at this a little bit, you'll notice that it doesn't have this feature in it, which is the change in slope of the curve. That's because I wired the two ends of the altimeter up backwards and put the main out at Apogee again. And so you notice it was an extra, minute and a quarter, minute and a half of time, which meant I had about another three-quarters of a mile to walk to retrieve it. And that would have been okay, except by
not only that, but yours was like 50 meters higher than
that's
mine
right.
on the ground.
You notice the ending altitude of mine was higher, and that's because it landed up on top of the hill behind
so
the flight.
So you walked further and had to go uphill.
The worst part, though, is by the time I got back with my rocket, Keith was already into his second Bundaberg, so, you know. Okay, a few other cool flights. Because we can fly different accelerometer parts, I felt this intense need to need more than the 50G part. And our friends at Cesarone came out with this new really high impulse motor. It's only an H, but it's 399 newtons average thrust. So I took this near minimum diameter rocket I had, and I tried flying it on one, and I got 49.12 Gs. And I looked at it, and I said, I have a hacksaw. This is overstable. So I cut 12 inches of length off the rocket and then carefully went through the recovery harness and took out all the metal. I took out all the quick links, I took out all the swivels and everything, and just tied the Kevlar to everything. Took it back up. My wife was laughing at me one night because I had put fluorescent pink on the tail can so it would be easy to find out in the grass and the grasslands. And then she sort of got her head wrapped around the fact that I was, it was all about G's. And she suggested we rename the rocket. And the guys on the flight line weren't real sure about this name. And they really weren't real sure about that description until they fired it. And it just kind of went, boom! And in fact, it pulled 52.8 Gs off the rail. So that was... So then that same day in the afternoon, Keith took the rocket he'd built for the drag race...
And put a much bigger motor in it called a Moonburn, a K350 motor. So
it's a full K motor.
The funny thing is the motor was so long that I had to remove a bunch of stuff from the end of the motor and adjust the inside of the rocket so that it would fit inside.
And in fact, that meant that Keith, for the first time, didn't have room to put a drogue parachute in.
Bummer.
And so Jason and I talked him into flying at Drogos. Jason's one of our good friends. And
so that's where the rocket just comes apart at Apogee and then just tumbles. without any actual recovery harness.
Yeah, it has a piece of Kevlar tying the two pieces together, so they sort of twirl, but there's no parachute. And that thing burned for 9.8 seconds. It's amazing.
Oh, man, it was sweet. It was way up in the sky, and it was still burning.
Okay, so the last sort of interesting flight in the series, we took my rocket from that, and we flew it on the 21st of November. This is our most recent thing. This is the first time we flew with the GPS part that we ended up deciding to go with. And by hashing together the barometric elevation data, because GPS elevation is pretty lousy, with the GPS discovered Latin Long, and then exporting that to Google Earth, we actually got this sort of 3D image of what the flight looked like. And in fact, you can see this time I had it wired correctly. After tumbling all the way down, the main parachute came out there. It settled down a nice, gentle, settled back down to the ground.
But you can see the winds aloft move the rocket around a lot. So finding the rocket where it is on the ground from where it was up in the sky, if you can't see it coming down, really hard.
This is why having GPS is a big deal. So where are we going from here? We have done a version 0.2 of the board, and the big feature is that the SkyTrack Venus GPS is now fully integrated onto the board with a patch antenna. We changed to an Atmel data flash part that gives us right now 2 megabytes instead of 128 kbytes, not because we need more space, but
there's
because
only
they're
three
cheaper.
Of those.
The ejection charge circuit was changed. I'd be happy to talk to folks that are curious about that. It got rid of the 1,000 microfarad electrolytic cap hanging up off the board that we didn't really know what to do with mechanically. We took out the discrete temperature sensor because it turns out it doesn't matter. We don't need it for cowling the sensors. And buried inside the rocket, we don't see enough temperature change to be interesting. That may come back on a companion board using the new companion interface at some point, if we can figure out where to put a temp sensor to get some interesting data. We changed to connectors we like a whole lot better that don't require multi-$100 crimping tools to use. And all the bugs in version 0.1 were fixed. And I'm still stunned, but it's the first time I've ever sent out a four-layer circuit board artwork for fabrication, had it come back, loaded boards up, and had no copper errors that we found yet in the board. It's really cool. And this is what one looks like. The bottom one is a version 0.1. The top one's an 0.2. You see it had to get massively bigger. It's another quarter of an inch longer circuit board. And the part, the big square part up in the top, is the GPS chip that got added. If you look at both sides of the new board, you'll see I've moved all the through-hole parts, including the GPS patch antenna, to the other side of the board. That made it possible to route this a little more professionally and have it be kind of clean. And from here, we're hoping, as soon as we're back from the conference, to start flying these new boards. A week ago Sunday, we got the first three protos of the new version fired up. Keith didn't have a whole lot of work to do.
Same parts everywhere except for the data flash.
But I certainly had a lot to do. Then there are some other things that we want to do. We have been approached by lots of folks in the hobby who are all excited about it, so we are trying to figure out how to have enough of these commercially assembled to be able to sell some of them. If you're interested in all of that, follow our website, and at some point I'm sure we'll have some details about that up. I did want to point out, after sort of blurting out in the middle of the Arduino MiniConf the other day, I do think it's important to understand the choice of license if you're trying to do open hardware designs. The Tapper open hardware license was written by intellectual property attorneys who understand the issues to convey a GPL-like set of characteristics for hardware designs. I consulted on the creation of that license, so I'm not unbiased about this, but I think this is the right license to use if you want GPL-like characteristics for hardware designs, and I'd encourage you to learn about it if you want to do this stuff. So with that, I think we're pretty much done with the official part of the presentation, except that I'd love to spend about 2 minutes showing you a highly amusing video, if we can do that before we get totally kicked out.
Just hit space. Get the mouse in the window and hit space.
It's the getting the mouse in the window part.
I know. I'm just gonna F now.
Woot! Screaming monkeys in space! This summer, at the Southern Colorado Rocketeers' inaugural Chili Blaster event near Pueblo, Colorado, rocket enthusiast Beat Ale Garby launched the first rocket ever, as far as we know, to fly with a crew of Woot.com screaming monkeys. Garvey hand-selected an elite crew of 8 Woot Monkeys, the best of the best, and put them through a rigorous and intensive physical and technical training program to ensure each monkey would be up to the daring task of manning Garvey's 6-foot-8-inch orange and black modified polecat rocket, the Goblin. Let's watch the launch.
Pat his arm. You're going in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go.
Dale, I think you got it.
Hang on, it gets better.
I've got B-Dale. There's his mane.
There it is!
B-Dale is under mane.
B-Dale's got his mane out. I got them both.
There it is!
Jason will be down first.
B-Dale's is still coming down.
Got B-Dale.
There it is! Right at horizon!
Gosh,
it's going
coming down.
It's going in the canyon.
And it's behind the tree.
Behind the tree.
That's the not far.
Garvey's monkey crew reached an altitude of 6,636 feet at Apogee, burning more than $300 worth of fuel along the way. Tragically, upon recovering the rocket, the ground crew found only 2 of the monkeys on board, having saved themselves by becoming entangled in the parachute shrouds. The 6 other members of the monkey crew were last seen in what witnesses on the ground called, quote, a cloud of sparkles. The rest of us might find some comfort in remembering that these missing 6 monkeys knew the risks, and that their sacrifice helped make this launch the spectacular success that it was. Kudos to B-Dale Garvey and to all the Southern Colorado Rocketeers who reject the tyranny of Earth's gravity, as well as traditional notions of what a normal person ought to pursue as a hobby.
So we've definitely overstayed our welcome in the room. Thanks very much for your time and attention. We'll be outside and around the rest of the week if you have questions.
Oh, we need our hardware back, though.
Oh, yeah. Hardware. Please. Please. Oh, it's another ground station machine.
We love that.
By the way, the OLPC XO is our ground station of choice because we love screens that work in sunlight.
Oh, thank you. Yes. Oh. Massive amounts of data. Yeah. So the graphs are static. The graphs are not dynamic. Thank you. No. Oh, thank you. I'm using it's a plotting library that uses Cairo for its output, and so we can emit SVG or PNG or whatever. It's a C program, of course. Thank you. Thank you. We're still missing 2 original telemetrums and a swath of PC boards. Thank you. Oh, I didn't know they'd lost it.